Hub.
And Spoke. Audio Collective.
You're listening to Nocturne. I'm Vanessa Lowe. Many of us have struggled with insomnia at various times in our lives. Sleep is affected by many factors, including stress, illness, having kids, aging. Reactions to sleep disturbances range from mild irritation to angst to downright terror and despair. Annabelle Abbs's journey through insomnia began in those familiar places, but ultimately led her to discoveries that completely changed her life.
My name is Annabelle Abbs. Sometimes I'm known as Annabelle Abbs Streets. And I am a writer living mostly in London, but sometimes in the countryside on the edge of a dark sky reserve. I have four children and I write books, fiction and nonfiction, and journalism. And I'm a very keen walker. So back in December 2020, you may remember it was the sort of the end of the first year of the pandemic. There were still no vaccines, and here in the UK, we were still cycling in and out of lockdowns. During this time, I suffered a series of bereavements, none of which were actually the result of COVID. So first of all, my beloved stepfather died. He died in a home. None of us had been able to go near him for weeks. We hadn't been able to say goodbye. 6 weeks after he died, my father died. Who I was very, very close to. And both those deaths were completely unexpected and very sudden, out of the blue, really. Then I got a puppy for my four children. I thought, okay, that we can all start to heal over this little puppy. And without realizing it, we had bought our puppy from a puppy mill. And within 4 days of getting this little puppy home, she was dangerously, dangerously ill. And she then died in isolation at a veterinary hospital just after Christmas Day, and we weren't able to say goodbye to her. So at this stage, we were just reeling from this series of deaths. And then there was another death 2 weeks after the puppy. And in many ways, this was the worst death of all, really. My 17-year-old daughter, her friend, he took his own life.
Annabelle and her family had been living in the strange world of COVID with the fear and uncertainty that many were experiencing. Days were full of all the tasks of daily life and the new addition of homeschooling. At night, she'd already begun to have a lot of trouble sleeping.
But these four deaths were so utterly devastating that I stopped sleeping altogether. And I had always been frightened of the dark, and I had always been made very anxious by insomnia that I'd had off and on since the birth of my first child. And I'd just sort of spent a lot of time just awake at night trying to get back to sleep and feeling quite angry and anxious about being awake. But suddenly the night completely changed and I started to fall in love with the darkness and the silence and the stillness. And I felt as though there was a reason that I was not sleeping. I wasn't sleeping because I had so many things that needed processing. And I started to see night as a place where we could heal, where we could ask difficult questions, where we could search for answers in a way that wasn't possible during the day. So at night, I couldn't sleep, but I started to find a sort of peace and respite. And over a period of a few weeks, the night became a place of sanctuary for me.
As Annabelle began to fall in love with the darkness, she started to venture into the night beyond the walls of her home. She began right outside her bedroom window.
I started sleeping out on this little tiny sliver of tin roof that was just outside my bedroom. And I didn't mean to sleep out, but one night I thought, I'm just going to lie out under the stars, and this was about 8 o'clock in the evening, so it wasn't late, but it was dark. I thought, I'm just going to lie under the stars, and then I'll get into my bed and see if I can get any sleep. And I'd been lying under the stars, which I'd never done in my life before, and just feeling incredibly calm. I don't think I've ever felt quite as calm as I did. And I was just looking at the stars, and for the first time in months, I fell asleep. And I just fell asleep for hours. And I sort of woke up, and it must have been about 3 a.m., and I thought, oh, I'm outside. And I thought, well, I'm going to be awake for hours now because I'm outside. And I just looked up at the stars again and just sort of drifted back off. And it was the first time I'd had really such a full night of sleep for months and months. And I started to think, this is really strange. I'm outside, you know, it's cold, it's damp, but I've slept like a log. And of course, later I dug into the science of that, and there's a lot of evidence that, you know, when we look up, all sorts of things change in our brain.
Research shows that when we look above the horizon, areas of the brain are activated that are usually engaged during meditation, religious experiences, creativity, and dreaming.
But just looking at the night sky seems to be a very, very relaxing and calming activity. And at the same time, there was a sort of predictability to it. And I love the fact that, you know, thinking these stars, they've been there forever. They're going to be there forever. Perhaps all the people I've lost, perhaps they're all up there somewhere. And there was a sense of possibility in the night sky that I didn't find during the day. So after that, I started to sleep out most nights when it wasn't raining.
Sleeping outside led to walking outside at night, despite her intrinsic primal fear of doing so.
So here in the UK, very few women will go for a walk in the middle of the night. But when you've been awake night after night, month after month, you do start to get a bit bored. So partly it's like, oh, I need something else to do, because that's quite a long period of time when everyone else is asleep and you can't do anything that makes a noise. You can't go and unstack the dishwasher. I mean, you start to think, well, maybe I should go outside. But also there's something about grief that I think sort of changes your priorities a little bit. So when you are grieving, there's a sense that, you know, who cares? I don't care anymore. You know, I've been so battered by this bereavement that, you know, it can't get any worse. So I'm just going to go out there.
Annabelle began by walking in her garden.
It was definitely baby steps.
She started bit by bit to expand her nighttime walking, like going on guided night walks instead of tossing and turning at home in bed.
And the more I walked, the more I absolutely loved it.
Annabelle's extreme insomnia and subsequent discovery of the healing quality of the night occurred at an interesting moment.
About this time, I'd already actually started working on a book about women who were awake at night and who used their nights to do things that were largely creative. And I'd been working on this book for about 6 months. So it was really strange when suddenly I couldn't sleep at all.
The women Annabelle was writing about included Sylvia Plath, Virginia Woolf, Lee Krasner, and dozens more. In a strange twist of fate, these creative women began to take on a much more poignant role in her own life.
I called these women my night spinners. Because, well, actually, a lot of them were spinning at night. A lot of women used to spin wool at night, often in spinning bees. They would go to each other's houses, sit around the fire and spin. So that was where the idea of the night spinner came from. But a lot of them were spinning stories, they were spinning drawings, they were spinning all sorts of creative threads. And as my nights became longer and longer and more wakeful, I found myself turning to these women, most of whom were from the past, some from the quite distant past, and they too became my nocturnal allies, really, my night friends.
Annabelle's night friends helped her learn how to inhabit the night in many ways.
I found a source of sustenance in how they had coped with the insomnia and the darkness and the being awake. Because I realised that these women didn't have the fear of the dark that I think we now have, and I certainly had. was really helped by reading, I'll give you the example of Dorothy Wordsworth, who was William Wordsworth's sister. If you read through her journals, she is always going out for a walk in the night, and she talks about the darkness, and she talks about the raindrops in moonlight, and she makes it sound so beautiful and so peaceful and so still. So I had her in the back of my voice. She was always sort of urging me on.
On a more basic level, the night spinners gave Annabelle permission to simply be awake.
They didn't have the sleep anxiety and the sense that it's not okay to be awake, that we have to be asleep.
The sense that it was not okay to be awake, that it might in fact be very dangerous to not get the recommended 8 hours of sleep, was in the cultural zeitgeist around the time Annabelle was struggling, due to one particular best-selling book. But the night spinners were proof that this didn't have to be true.
For them, night was often a wonderful opportunity for them to take some time for themselves, whether that was to do something creative or to catch up on work they hadn't managed to do during the day, or whether it was just a time of caring. And in fact, prior to about 300 years ago, when there were no hospitals at all, the role of caring for all of the sick fell to women in the towns, the villages and the cities. So by this stage, I was reading through, you know, hundreds and hundreds of journals and diaries and letters, often unpublished. And in these letters and diaries, women were often talking about their nights, which were certainly nothing like the 8 hours of, you know, uninterrupted sleep that we are all urged to have. So for these women, it was perfectly normal to be awake, often all night, and certainly sort of throughout the night.
Annabelle's night spinners transformed her relationship to her insomnia.
They gave me a sense of comfort in my own sleeplessness, a sense of reassurance that I wasn't going to die imminently. So a lot of the headlines these days are, you know, if you don't get the right amount of sleep at the right time, you will, you know, you will become obese, you will get type 2 diabetes, you will up your risk of dementia, and you will die prematurely. I realised that this actually wasn't the case. So that gave me the confidence to, you know, put away what I called my chest of sleep aids. I'd always had this little box of things that I took to help me sleep on bad nights. And now I decided that my sleeplessness was so bad, I had two options really, which was either to, you know, to take medication, sleeping pills, or to embrace the journey. And having this very clear sense that women going back for hundreds of years had embraced the journey of sleeplessness themselves and of being really at ease in the night and finding something in the night that was uniquely theirs, that meant that I stopped panicking about the fact that I couldn't sleep. And as soon as you relax, I think, and sort of go with the night, you are released from your daytime way of thinking, and you're much, much calmer than if you're lying there tossing and turning, thinking, oh, I'm not going to be able to function properly tomorrow. Oh, if I don't sleep, this is going to be the end of my life. Many of these women lived well into their 90s. So I was able to take comfort from that, really.
It turns out that women are more likely to be awake at night for a number of reasons.
So women are affected disproportionately by insomnia. We are much more likely to suffer from anxiety and depression, which often lead, you know, directly into insomnia. Our sleep architecture is frailer. So recent studies have shown that, you know, women are much more likely to wake up when under anaesthetic. We come round much more quickly from an anaesthetic. We have many more of these micro arousals at night when we're sleeping. So our sleep is, I would say, sort of more frail and perhaps flimsier than the way in which men sleep. And some people now think this is because of testosterone, that men sleep more deeply. And of course, we have less of that. So there seems to be a biological reason for women sleeping not as well. But also women, of course, go through these quite dramatic hormonal changes, all of which affect our sleep. And then, of course, those of us that have had children know that, you know, your sleep is interrupted often, night after night after night, for year after year after year. Then, of course, there's the menopause, and that's when we start to see our estradiol slipping away, and estradiol also has been linked to sleep. So in general, women find it more difficult to get to sleep and to stay asleep and to get a full night of sleep. So it made sense that women were more likely to be awake at night. Also, of course, women historically have always had much busier days in terms of all the housework and the caring. So often night was the only time they could get for themselves. And of course, the other thing is that women typically weren't really allowed to do a lot of the creative things, the painting and the writing and even the studying. Those things were, you know, they were a male prerogative. So many of the accounts I found were of women doing things secretly in the dark at night. A lot of these were female scientists, and there's one case, a woman called Mary Somerville. She was very young. She's one of our earliest British great scientists. And as soon as her parents discovered that she was using candles at night to study mathematics, they just locked up all the candles. So it was always challenging for women to do these things. And night, really, the secrecy of night provided them with the perfect opportunity to do something for themselves.
While gender differences in sleep patterns are interesting, what I find to be even more compelling is what Annabelle discovered next.
When I was awake night after night and thinking about these women and starting to do some of the things that they had done, I noticed that my way of thinking was quite different. I felt different. My emotions were different. I started to get this idea that I was a different sort of person at night. And I called this my night self. She was really quite different. And initially I thought, well, this is just me. Maybe it's me and these other night spinners. Maybe we're just a little bit unsettled by the darkness. Maybe we're just tired. But in 2022, when I was sort of in the middle of this book and desperately hoping for some evidence that other people were also a little bit weird at night, this report dropped onto my desk, and it was called The Mind After Midnight. And it was the very first study of the awake at night brain. So prior to this report, there had been many, many studies and investigations into the sleeping brain. And there have also been many, many studies of sleep deprivation. So we know quite a lot now about dreaming and how the brain shifts through these cycles of sleep. But no one until this point had looked at, you know, what is happening to the brain when it's awake in the middle of the night, when it should perhaps possibly be asleep. So this study, The Mind After Midnight, looked specifically at people with depression and anxiety. And it found that at night, we behave in a way, I think, that's best described as slightly more reckless. So this study looked at reformed smokers and found that they were more likely to start smoking if they were awake in the middle of the night. People on diets were more likely to go to the fridge and eat a large slice of chocolate cake in the middle of the night. Reformed alcoholics were more likely to have a drink. People who were awake were more likely to take their own life or to self-harm. So there seemed to be a recklessness and a risk-taking associated with being awake in the night.
Annabelle reached out to the lead researcher of the Mind After Midnight study, and they began an email correspondence about how the brain changes at night.
And one of the main things that happens is that a part of the brain called the prefrontal cortex, which sits just behind our forehead. It's the bit of the brain that is most responsible for thinking in an orderly way. It's very good at evaluating and judging and weighing up risk versus reward. It's the part of the brain that our whole civilization is built on, really. It's very rational. It's very methodical. And this bit of the brain, which is making thousands of tiny decisions all day long, becomes tired during the evening. As darkness falls, it starts to go into partial hibernation.
So the part of your brain that you might think of as that which powers your daytime self sort of pulls back at night. What's more, gender differences are at play here, just like with insomnia.
Now, in women, the prefrontal cortex is larger and it's more active. So for a woman, having a prefrontal cortex that is shut down is very, very freeing. Because we're very good at self-inhibiting, being judgmental of ourselves. And so if that part of the brain that does all of the clever sort of analytical stuff, but also the judging of ourselves, if that part of the brain goes to sleep, what happens? And I wondered if this was why so many of these women produced such very, very different work during the night. And also, a lot of the women would talk about how incredibly different their work was. If you look at a painter like Joan Mitchell, she started to paint at night. And after the first few nights of painting, you know, she got up and she looked at these paintings one day and she said, where the hell have they come from? Virginia Woolf, who's a very well-known British modernist writer, she wrote a novel called Orlando. On Orlando, she made up as she lay in bed. I think she wrote it during the day, but the ideas came to her during the night and she just lay there and the sort of the narrative just sort of unfolded. And when the book came out, rather to everyone's surprise, it was very different from anything else she'd written.
Of course, proving gender differences in a concept like the night self is a pretty subjective endeavor. Annabelle is convinced, though, not only by studying her night spinners, but by hearing contemporary accounts.
Since the book was published, I've gone on the road and done lots and lots of talks, and men are always a little bit bemused and baffled by this idea of a night self, whereas women are all, oh my gosh, yes, I have one too. And time and time again, I came across these words that women would put in their writings about these extraordinary experiences that they'd had at night. And this sense that so many of these women were producing things that they couldn't really understand, you know, where had this ability to put words together in such a fresh and original way? How had that happened? So this I found fascinating, and I decided that this was definitely the prefrontal cortex sort of shutting down and giving women a sense of freedom and liberation, but also that changing of the brain at night, the rewiring for nocturne, was in itself a fascinating subject. Men very rarely talked about that. So men have also always worked at night. So writers like Kafka and Proust always wrote at night, but they never really commented on how different it was, and they didn't seem to write things that were different at night. Whereas what the women wrote, you could clearly see, if you look at Sylvia Plath's poetry, the poems she wrote at night, they're completely different to the poems that she had written earlier during the day. So this sense that a nocturnally rewired brain might be operating really struck me.
This idea of a nocturnally rewired brain led Annabelle to reassess how she felt about who she was at night and to accept it.
When you understand the biology of your night self and you know that your brain is wired differently, that your brain changes over the course of the night, that your brain changes literally when darkness falls, and this is a circadian, partially evolutionary response, then I think it's much easier to accept your night self. It's much easier to accept things when you can understand them, or you think you can understand them. So previously, my night self had just been a rather irritating person that couldn't get to sleep and, you know, made me anxious and stressed. But I came to like my night self a lot, because now my night self became a source of seeing things differently, sort of changing the lens on my diurnal perspectives on everything. It became a way, or she became a way, of tackling problems that often I couldn't find a solution to in the day. So I would often, if during the day I came up against a sort of a writing problem, for example, I didn't know how to start a chapter, I didn't know how to tackle a particular character, I would just park it. And I would think, okay, when I wake up in the night, because I did wake up every night, when I wake up in the night, I will go straight back to that problem and let's see what happens. And 9 times out of 10, when I woke up in the night and went back to that problem that I'd had during that day, an answer just came sort of mysteriously. And I would just think, that's how to do it. That's how to start this chapter. That's what to do with this difficult character. And I really liked the way in which my brain was finding solutions at night that it didn't seem able to find during the day.
As tends to happen, when Annabelle stopped struggling against sleeplessness and began to actually treasure those quiet moments of darkness, things changed again.
As soon as I had really started to have all these sort of very regular encounters with my night self, and I started to think, oh, this is great. I really love the night. I love my night self. This is a whole new way of being. Of course, my sleep returned. I guess that's partly because all the sleep anxiety and the worry about, you know, having insomnia, that had just gone out of the window. Instead, I'd found something, you know, really lovely that I wanted to hang on to. And suddenly, then I was just sleeping. I was just sleeping through the night, which sort of, you know, which made me laugh. And of course, you know, it's good to sleep. Obviously, sleep's really important. So I would never set my alarm for the middle of the night so that I could spend time with my night self. But it does mean that now when I wake up, I don't fret. And if I don't go back to sleep in the 10 or 15 minutes, I get up, or, you know, I go for a walk, or I sit and do some writing, or I do some drawing. And that also feels, you know, just feels wonderful.
Along with the easing of Annabelle's insomnia, the grief that had sparked it was also softening.
And I think it's probably important to say that perhaps the really big piece of this was coming to terms with all of the loss and being able to process the grief. So the night, it was really a healing place for me, and it enabled me to just make sense of things that actually didn't make any sense during the day, but suddenly at night they did. I mean, obviously the death made sense during the day, but it didn't really make sense. It made much more sense at night because I felt as though these weren't losses. During the day, of course, I think, you know, people have died and that's it. You just have to accept it. But at the night, my night self would say, well, they're not here during the day, but actually at night, they probably are here. So that less empirical part of the brain, because that worked at night, I was able to, I think, accommodate a more mystical way of thinking that I probably wouldn't have allowed myself during the day. The sort of the empirical day brain is, well, don't be so ridiculous, you know. But when people have died, they've died. But the night brain is much more forgiving, much more receptive, much more open to ideas that the day brain doesn't really like to engage with. And so that process of coming to terms with really difficult emotions was triggered really by spending so much time in the darkness. And for that, I'll always be incredibly grateful.
While the return of sleep has greatly reduced Annabelle's nocturnal wanderings, her relationship to the night has been forever altered.
I do actually do lots and lots of night things now. So my summer is filled with, you know, night walks to hear nightingales, night kayaking. So anything to do with the night, glowworm walks I'm organising. So it's introduced me to a whole new world and a whole new, I guess, series of adventures, really, that I would never have thought of doing before. So it has also given me access to many more interesting things just because I've now decided that I love everything that happens in the dark.
Annabelle's book, Sleepless, Unleashing the Subversive Power of the Night Self, came out in 2024. In it, she writes about the unexpected gift of her night self and shares how we can all experience and cultivate our own unique and mysterious night selves.
We all have night selves, and as I write, you know, yours is not mine. All our night selves are going to be slightly different according to who we are and how we're wired and how we think and how we believe. And so there are all of those things that will come into play. But I think that for anyone wanting to discover their night self, the first thing is you have to spend time in darkness. And for me, that meant, you know, not only turning off all the lights, but taping over all the little Wi-Fi, you know, our house is now full of little blue winking lights and, you know, smoke detector lights. And so there are lights everywhere. So I taped over them all to get complete darkness because that was also a very modern light. When I wake up now at night, I will really only light a candle. So I try not to use any artificial light. And I think that I would say to anyone, if you want to discover your night self, you know, first of all, open your window and look up. Secondly, if you feel able to go outside, maybe just into your garden, but if you want to go further, either with someone or on your own, whatever feels safe, you know, just try going out somewhere dark. The city doesn't really work because it's too bright and too light. Otherwise, I would also say, you know, try doing something creative and perhaps something that you don't normally do. So for me, I wrote poetry and lyrics because that was something that I would never do during the day. But you could try drawing, or you could try painting or embroidery, or just something that you perhaps normally wouldn't give yourself permission to do during the day because it would be unproductive, or you don't think you're very good at it. And I think you'll find that at night you're much less judgmental about what it is that you've produced, and you will probably be surprised at what you make.
My night self is simultaneously more grounded and more vulnerable, receptive but unfocused. Upon reflection, I realized that I rarely do my creative work at night, so I don't actually know how it would be affected. My night self likes to lounge and meander. In fact, seems to resist work in a way that's very distinct from my daytime self. It got me wondering if I could entice my nighttime brain to create with different incentives. Reassure her that nothing is expected. Maybe listen more to what she wants and see what she might offer in return.
Yes. Listen to your nocturnal inner voice and see how she or he sounds, and get to know your night self.
You've been listening to Nocturne. I'm Vanessa Lowe. Nocturne is produced by me and was created by myself and Kent Sparling, who also composed the theme music. You can find out more information about Nocturne at our website, nocturnepodcast.org. I'll post a link for Annabelle Abstreet's work on the website and the show notes for this episode. Thank you to everyone who supports Nocturne on Patreon and PayPal. I am so grateful. Big thank you to Tim Peters for supporting us at the Happy Possum level, which is our highest level of support. Find out how you can help keep us going at nocturnepodcast.org/support. Nocturne is a proud member of Hub and Spoke Audio Collective. Find out more about all the fantastic shows in Hub and Spoke at hubspokeaudio.org. Till next time, thanks for listening, and be well.